It's a pleasure to be here. I would like to thank the organizer for this invitation. Sorry that Richard is not here today, but he has good reasons. I understand this is the only, I mean, my talk is the only reason that we are not having lunch yet. So I'll try to be quicker than 1 hour. Hope you'll excuse me for that. Okay, so I will talk about electron, proton, and muon proton scattering for the interest of form factor measurements. I will discuss radiative corrections for the electron proton scattering, and in particular discuss what is model dependent, what is model independent, compare some theory with experiment, and new data from several labs that came about for the past years. Most recent was data from Olympus experiment in DESI that just published in December. So let's start from basics. So we want to study charge and magnetic response of the nucleons, and for that we use first Born approximation. However, so this is this would be coupling to the nucleon, and this is what all theories would consider as a matrix element of the electromagnetic operator. That's what you would predict on the lattice. Other models, this is exactly what you are considering theoretically when you study the structure of the nucleon. However, since the charge is accelerated when you scatter it on the target, accelerated charge always emits a photon. So whether you have initial state radiation or final state radiation, it should happen with 100% probability. If you look at the cross section of the photon emission, the cross section goes as photon energy over to the power minus 1. So when you calculate this integral, the integral diverges logarithmically, and we end up with infrared catastrophe. So how to figure that out? It was thanks in part by Schwinger in 49. When you add vertex correction, it also diverges. So when you add things up, if you look at the interference between this and this, it cancels with this at the level of the cross section. So this is a famous formula by Schwinger that he derived in 49. And that's what we're dealing with. Usually we assume that momentum transfer Q squared is much larger than mass of the lepton that is being scattered. On the top of this, you are considering the following. Since the Bremsstrahlung is logarithmically divergent at low energies, you immediately end up with a situation when you are taking a photon, radiating a single photon, and if it is very low energy, your coupling of the photon is proportional to electric charge, and there is also logarithm of the energy, so you are not dealing with a small parameter alpha, you are actually dealing with small parameter alpha times logarithm, and this logarithm can explode. We are dealing in this case with non-perturbative QED. So to take care of this, you would need resummation, and one example is Yeni-Frau-Chasura procedure of exponentiation. This was revisited later, but still the exponentiation procedure in the first order is a good approach. So what happens next? Field of electron scattering, precision electron scattering, was actually put into doubt in the 60s because people said once you have this radiation, if you look at the formulas that I just showed you, Schwinger correction, the the correction is proportional to, of course, electromagnetic structure, fine structure constant alpha. This is 1 over 37, but it is also multiplied by large logarithms, log of q squared over me squared, and this is about factor of 15 in the range of experience that we are considering. Then there is also some logarithm of energy resolution. So altogether, depending on energy resolution of your detectors, you end up with about 30% correction to your cross section. So to people coming from hadronic scattering, for example, it's a big surprise when you go to electron scattering field and you tell your student that after taking all this data, you have to multiply it by 0.7 to get to correct result. That is a big surprise. Now the question is, out of this 30% typical radiative correction to electron scattering, what is well predictable and what is model dependent? So there have been some approaches. Most famous is Moy and Tsai from the 60s, particularly developed for deep inelastic scattering at SLAG. Later, Bardeen and Shoemaker in the 70s developed some improvement over Moy and Tsai, in particular in treating infrared problem and through dimensional regularization, and also what they did, they very carefully considered polarization effects, spin polarization. Kurai, Fadin, and Merenkov, this Novosibirsk group, and Merenkov is my colleague from Kharkov in Ukraine, they developed an interesting approach based on Altarelli-Parisi resummation of collinear radiation, whether it is radiation or pair production. It's a method called electron structure functions, and it was applied by us for polarized electron positron scattering. Electron proton scattering. So what is electromagnetic form factors that we want to study? If you have just one photon exchange first Born approximation, you parameterize matrix element with two form factors. You have parity conservation, current conservation. You have two form factors only. These are real functions in the space-like region, and you square matrix element, you obtain cross section. So this is known as Rosenbluth formula, where you have magnetic form factor squared and electric form factor squared. This is momentum square, and this is q squared over 4m squared. This is momentum transfer, and this epsilon is a parameter that basically tells you where you are in the center of mass scattering angle. So if you have forward scattering, epsilon goes to 1, and if you have backward scattering of electron, epsilon goes to 0. In the 60s, a couple of guys in Ukraine, Rikala and Akhiezer, who also was my thesis advisor in Ukraine, they proposed a different technique to measure form factors. So in the Rosenbluth technique, you want to measure form factor a certain q squared, and you want to separate magnetic and electric piece. So you fix q squared, which means that at different electron scattering energies and different angles, you obtain the same q squared. But so you have a couple of points, and the slope in this Rosenbluth plot would give you electric form factor squared, and intercept at epsilon goes to 0 would give you magnetic form factor squared. So that is known as Rosenbluth technique. However, there is one complication in the Rosenbluth technique, and this is the following. Magnetic form factor squared, if you believe dipole formula, it has the magnetic moment here in units of Bohr magnetons. So this is like factor of 10 compared to G squared, okay? And then on the top of it, you have this momentum transfer multiplying the magnetic contribution. So when you want to measure form factor at several GeV squared, this contribution is much larger. So typically, if you believe dipole formula that later was shown to fail, But if you believe dipole formula, it's 6 JV squared, 7 JV squared, this piece in the cross-section is about 5% compared to this piece. So it's a small piece. If you want to extract electric form factor, you have to deal with measuring cross-section at definitely better than 1% accuracy. So to avoid this complication, you might want to consider polarization transfer that was implemented at the Jefferson lab. So you come with polarized electrons, you knock out a proton out of the target, and you put the polar emitter, so you you have scattering of the proton in some carbon recoil polar emitter. You measure secondary scattering, so the recoil polar polarized proton will produce a symmetry due to spin orbit interaction in the scattering of carbon, and that's the way you measure it. So it involves double scattering. So experiment is complicated. So no wonder that while this technique was proposed in the beginning of 60s, it was actually realized around year 2001. Year 2000, when GLAPS was operational. Prior to that, it was experiment at MIT Bates also. And it is considered now a big achievement of Jefferson Lab, that one of the original releases. So that's JLab located in Hampton Roads here. That's where I spent about 17 years before going to DC. And so there are three experimental holes, hole A, hole B, and hole C. The racetrack-shaped accelerator superconducting, and all the equipment is there in the holes. There is also a free electron laser located here, a small accelerator at around 50 MeV energy. So that was original result from Jefferson Lab on the measuring the ratio of electric to magnetic form factor. And in all classical parameterizations that assume the dipole formula works, it would be one, it would be constant. But what was actually measured, it was something that was crossing zero. So the problem was the following. The problem that these green experimental dots were actually results of Rosenbluth measurement, unpolarized particles, while this new data came from polarization measurements. So the crisis erupted because two groups disagreed, and the question was how to reconcile this measurement. So that's the same plots again. So this is polarization data, and these are Rosenbluth data. And later, during the time around 2002-2003, the group in Jefferson Lab also decided to do slightly different measurement. So instead of measuring form factor by detecting electron in the final state, they measured form factor detecting proton in the final state. So this was called super Rosenbluth data. And they were assuming that the radiative corrections were smaller in that case, so the systematics would be reduced. Radiative corrections were indeed a little smaller, but not very small. So now the question was raised by Van der Hagen, Pierre Guichon, and Mark Van der Hagen in their paper from 2003. The paper used some extreme language for describing the situation. So the wording was like confusion and doubt in this field, and so nobody knows whether you can believe any data. So we did some work here, and let me identify the radiative corrections that we actually have to deal with. So we have electron scattering, so we have coupling to the proton here that is dependent on the structure of the hadron. This is the biggest issue actually, is that hadron has structure here. And otherwise you works through standard multi-loop calculation at any order that you want. But in this case, we only have a model-independent piece coming from coupling, extra coupling of the photons to the lepton line. But the problem with coupling of the photons to the hadronic line is outstanding. This type of two-photon exchange diagrams are actually causing big issues in theoretical calculation. So Guichon and van der Hagen said, in order to reconcile the polarization and Rosenblum data, you need, as I said, about 5% in the cross section, recover 5% in the cross section. So they said it's 3% in the amplitude, because the correction is twice real part of the interference. So of course, 3% in the amplitude results in 6% in the cross section. So you need to catch this missing 6% in the cross section or 3% in the amplitude. 3% in the amplitude means it might go between, the correction might go between -1.5% to +1.5% across the angular range of the measurement, and that will give you the answer to the discrepancy. So some calculations were done theoretically. It was Blandelman, Nichuk, and John, 2003, actually Stan Brodsky was at Jefferson Lab for sabbatical at the time, and when he saw van der Hagen's paper, he said, "Oh no, it's wrong, because two-photon exchange diagram calculated on a structureless particle predicts zero two-photon exchange effect in the forward scattering." So, these suggestions of Guichon and van der Hagen cannot be true. So we set up some calculation with Brodsky and Carlson, but about 2 months later, Mark van der Hagen came to position in Williamsburg, and he joined us in this effort to demonstrate that his estimates were not correct. So he helped with that very nicely, and Chen was his postdoc, actual grad student. So we did this calculation in a particular model that I will describe a little later.
So just one comment on the previous slide. So even the diagram G is slightly problematic, not saying from this context, but just calculating it, because you have this internal line where it's no longer a proton there.
I would say that diagram G is already, you can redefine it into the form factor of the proton. It's basically electromagnetic piece in the form factor of the proton. Right?
As I recall from, I guess it wasn't my paper, but I think there were some issues how you actually do that, and there's some old dependence that goes into these things.
This is as problematic, but the good thing is that this looks like a radiative correction to the proton form factor, and what you measure, it's already included in there.
Right. So what I'm saying that this is, again, there's an internal line there. Mm-hmm. There is no internal line. Mm-hmm. I'm saying it's not the same proton that goes inside the loop, because it's no longer
true.
A proton.
He wants you to put the blob over there.
Yeah, let's increase the size of the blob, right? And your question will be solved, right? Right. So now, how do you do this two-photon exchange, and how it was done before? So in fact, when you look at the approaches, when Tsai actually did radiative correction calculation for elastic proton scattering, electron proton scattering, the part of two-photon exchange diagrams were already included there. Otherwise, this discrepancy with polarization would be twice as large. The way it was done is the following. So if you take this type of diagram plus cross diagram, then you assume that one photon is extremely close to extremely low energy. It's, of course, it's a stretch, and it's non-covariant concept. Energy is not a covariant thing. So you might think of different ways to identify this infrared type photon, but it's because you always capture some non-infrared pieces in whatever procedure you choose. But the important thing is that when you set this photon on mass shell, you make it soft, you can calculate it exactly. You can this entire diagram factorizes out, so you have a result that is proportional to Born diagram times some infrared divergent factor. To cancel this infrared divergent factor, you need to consider interference between scattering from interference between photon emission from lepton line and photon emission from proton line. Then you, after you cancel this divergence, you realize, for example, this correction at 6 GV squared relative to slug goes from -5% to zero in the forward direction. So this is backward scattering, this is forward scattering. So this is a big contribution of the order of the size of the discrepancy, but it was already included in the data analysis. Now, the if you go beyond soft photon exchange approximation, you have to consider instead of two form factors of the proton, electric and magnetic, or Dirac and Pauli, you consider full structure of the amplitude. And in general, if you look at scattering of particle spin 1/2 and spin 1/2 that are not identical, and it is elastic scattering, you have parity constraint that gives you 8 amplitudes. Time reversal reduces the number to 6 amplitudes. And you can introduce independent helicity amplitudes and express all the observables that you're measuring in the experiment through these 6 amplitudes. Out of these 6 amplitudes, 3 corresponds to helicity flip of the lepton and 3 helicity conservation. So if you consider ultra-relativistic limit for electron scattering, 3 amplitudes are exactly zero, and you end up with 3 generalized form factors. Now, these 3 generalized form factors depend on 2 Mandelstam variables. You can have Q squared, and you can have something that is describing scattering angle. It could be epsilon, it could be Mandelstam mu, or whatever. There is a free choice. Of course, we can calculate two photon exchange on a structureless particle. So if you take a quark, you look at the, we can write down the amplitude, and it is interesting that if you just look at the spin structure of the amplitude, it looks like like product of convolution of vector and vector current, and product of axial and axial current. So we can write these form factors down at the quark level for massless quark. And it is reasonably simple expression. So it's not something unusual here. Sten Brodsky was especially excited about this pi squared terms because look, there is a logarithm of Mandelstam variables and there are squares of the logarithm. And when you go between annihilation channel and scattering channel, you have to do analytic continuation, right? So t goes from positive to negative. So as a result, you have logarithm with extra I pi. When you square it, you get pi squared. So it's interesting that in the scattering channel, you have pi squared, but in the annihilation channel, we have E plus E minus going to QQ bar pair, or the other way, this pi squared disappears. But pi squared is, it's almost 9, right? It's almost 10. So it's a big number. We did calculation with Brodsky, Carlson, Chen, and van der Hagen, and what we did, we did the following. It was a reasonable model from our point of view. So we look at the lepton quark scattering, and where hard kernel is described in the previous page. But we assume that also the quarks have some momentum distributions. And this momentum distribution of wave function of quarks were described by generalized parton distributions. These GPDs were taken from the fits to the actual form factors, and they're pretty stable. So what we predicted the effects, for example, because of this two photon exchange interfering with one photon exchange, is proportional to charge of the lepton to the power 3. Because of that, it flips sign for positrons and electrons. And if you compare positron and electron scattering on the proton, there is some small asymmetry. So we predicted this asymmetry here. This were real data up to a couple of years ago. A slightly different approach was developed by Kolya Kivel and Mark van der Hagen in Mainz. So they looked at two photon exchange in perturbative QCD, where two photon couple to different quarks, but and it would require only one gluon to be exchanged, which is nice because in perturbative QCD, when you try to apply perturbative QCD to exclusive reactions, the more gluons you have, this is the worse, right? So if you can replace throw away one gluon exchange and keep only one gluon instead of two exchanges, that is a big advantage. So Kivel van der Hagen calculated this contribution that shows here, and we will see that a couple of percent effects are there. Yes.
Can you say a word about your modeling of diagram H? This real radiation diagram, you're not showing it here, but you showed it originally, and you talked about how you get the infrared part out of diagram H to cancel ENF. But in principle, diagram H has some non-perturbative piece as well.
This is virtual Compton scattering amplitude, and in the case of elastic scattering, we are only considering that this photon is very soft. And when the photon is very soft, it's just factorizes out.
So you rely upon complete reconstruction.
Yes. Yeah. So we didn't get into the dangerous region where this photon is hard, thanks for our experimental constraints that usually in the detector you can verify that the emitted photon, actual photon, are soft. I mean, you don't have this luxury in the loop diagram calculation. You have to go to infinity there. Let me go on. So how does it change the view on the cross section? So this is angular dependence on the cross section at slack, measured at slack, as a function of epsilon, this parameter epsilon. So it's zero in the backward, one in the forward. If you have one photon exchange, and if, believe Rosenblut formula, it is just a straight line. This is a straight line. The data actually looked something like that, right? So when you try to fit this data with straight line, you get a larger slope. Larger slope corresponds to larger electric form factors. Flat line corresponds to zero electric form factor. So if you look, for example, at 6 GeV squared, you have, very easy interpolation formula here, right? Because we have only two experimental points. So if you draw line through here, of course, it corresponds to larger electric form factor. But if you include corrections due to two photon exchange, that this is what the data, this is what the theory comparison would look like with this data. If we take very small electric form factor. So that allows us to claim that we can, with help of the two photon exchange, reconcile this difference between the polarization and Rosenblut measurement.
Understand you said this, in order to get this, you take the quark level computation and you loop it with these generalized PDFs, which are very generalized. So
yes.
The proton goes in with one, proton comes out with the other, has all these other variables as well.
Yes.
And you said these are determined from the same?
These are mostly coming from magnetic form factor measurement. And it's pretty robust for magnetic form factor. We are not using this data to fit our model. No, there is no catch to meet it. The model for GPDs was coming from a combination of form factor fits and Compton scattering fits. They wouldn't depend much on electric form factor at all. mostly magnetic. It was primarily magnetic form factor of neutron and proton. So the.
And this type of factorization is assumed, or would it actually?
It's assumed.
Exactly if you would,
it's assumed. It's assumed that was a model dependence. So the our counterparts, Blandel, Melnichuk, and Chon, they assume something different, exactly opposite actually to what we assumed. They assume that proton remains a proton. So in the loop diagram, they put nucleon form factors, and assume that proton does not get excited. So even though it is off-shell and you don't really know what is off-shell proton, what it means, but they made this assumption, did the calculation, loop diagram calculation going to infinity, and get results very similar to ours in both in sign and magnitude. So I don't know if you are allowed to add them up, because partially we have some overlap, because we in the GPD in GPD picture you have some elastic like automatically included things in the generalized Parton distribution. So it might be double counting if we add up different approaches. But after doing this, we again compared with data, and this is what it looks like. So if you apply two-photon exchange to the analysis of data, the polarization measurement practically do not move. They stay. Might change by a couple of percent. But this couple of percent applied to cross-section measurement made a huge difference. So the reapplying the radiative correction, you get this data moving almost by sigma down in toward agreement with Rosenblatt polarization. So the green dot is reapplied radiative correction for this blue experimental data. So the same data but with new radiative correction. On the top of it, you also consider a more accurate Bremsstrahlen calculation. So if you take electron scattering and do not use certain approximations. So make sure that, for example, the amplitude of Bremsstrahlen is calculated without assuming that the energy of the photon is very, very low. After you do this, you have additional shift here. So this point goes even down here. So all this accurate calculation in QED are really important. So this is a result of this. So remember standard Klein-Nishina cross-section without spin involved. It looks like this, a Klein-Nishina amplitude. But we also added some pieces like that, and it gives extra percent actually at high energies. So, by the way, there is a new progress in particle nuclear physics just came out this month that we put together with Peter Blunden, Doug Hassel, and Brian Rao. So there are two theorists and two experimentalists. And we also give some nice overview of the current situation with two-photon exchange, especially because the measurements from Olympus experiment in DESY have been published. So if you look at the ways to control this contribution, now we have some theoretical prediction. They tell us that we have plausible explanation on this discrepancy. Now there is a way to measure it. And the way to measure it is by comparing positron and electron scattering on your target, because positron and electrons give you different signs for these two-photon exchange corrections. So the this is the summary of all data that came about. So this is a combination of Novosibirsk data, the green, Jefferson Lab data in class, that is red, and black is Olympus data. So you see that so this is a ratio, and you see the effects after you subtract soft photon correction that I already mentioned. What is left out is something at the level of 2%, effects. This has implications also for precision measurement of Pareto violating properties of the nucleon. So in particular, Carl Carlson and I noticed that since two-photon exchange, if you have hard two-photon exchange, it changes the spin structure. It's not factorizable. It changes the entire amplitude, spin structure of the amplitude. You may also have corrections to parity violation just coming from this that were previously neglected. So we calculated this. It was not a very significant effect for low energies, where the most of the experiments were done. But it also stimulated some calculation for two boson exchange box. So we have gamma and Z coupling. So when you look at this gamma Z coupling, this is from Carl Carlson talk from last year. And look at different calculations of this gamma Z box. What you end up is...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Could you show this amplitude again, this two photon for parity violation?
Here it is.
We did this in back in the 90s with Bill Marciano for...
I remember this work, yes.
...821.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
For the slack experiment.
Uh-huh.
They were included.
I remember the letter, the notation was there, right? So how big was the effect?
Oh, I have, 20 years ago. I don't know, but I remember struggling.
I remember your paper with Marciano. I remember Mike Musol's papers also discussing
so
that.
The whole one loop correction to the molar scattering was minus 40% roughly. We just discussed this at the break. That's what you guys found. Part of it was also this gamma Z mixing that was discussed in Iris' talk.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
not this non-perturbative contribution.
I don't remember the exact number calculated there, but what was important for us is that I think that you calculated this as a constant, right? You didn't calculate Q squared dependence.
Okay, I don't remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the critical thing here, since we are looking at Q squared, how it depends on Q squared, this was how it affects the form factors, weak form factors.
Okay.
And you looked, I now remember. You looked at very low energy limit.
Yes,
exactly. So we are looking at scattering situation. And so it results also in big discussion of contribution of gamma Z box to such a fundamental constant like weak charge of the proton, because my colleague Misha Gerstein from Mainz and Chuck Gorowitz, they evaluated this diagram, and the very first evaluation, of course, what you do with this series, you're pretty conservative. You allow your uncertainties to be large. So when they calculated this, they realized it's almost 50% uncertainty in measuring Q weak. I mean, weak charge of the proton, and all these experiments were already proved, right? So who is familiar with NSF and DOE funding procedure, right? Everything is approved, all the money are in place, all the graduate students are hired, and the postdocs are hired. I mean, to get your promotion and tenure, and everything already happened, but now some irresponsible theorist comes in and says that your measurement doesn't make any sense. Misha was in Indiana at the time. So it caused a real panic in the field, and people jumped into this calculation. So several groups, Hall is associated with Tony Thomas, I think, Carl Carlson, and Misha Gorenstein continued to work on this. So what was done is looking at dispersive calculation. So you have the two boson exchange diagram. You put a cut here, Katkowski cut. So you calculate imaginary part. How do you get the imaginary part? You get it from real data on non-forward amplitude where you have two bosons coupling. So you obtain it from some parameterizations of the deep inelastic structure functions, and you have to put some kind of assumption what this look like when the momentum transfer here is non-zero, because optical theorem will only give you information about forward Compton amplitude that is related to observable total cross-section. And you can relate it to the deep inelastic structure functions. But if the momenta of the of these bosons are different, or some virtuality also involved and they are also different, then you have to make some additional assumption how you proceed. Fortunately, the momentum transfers at this parity violating measurements are small. Because they are small, you can still be pretty close to forward region and rely on your dispersive calculation. So to end up, I mean, to summarize this gamma z box calculation, we realized it is now realized it's about 8%, between 8 and 6%, depending on how accurate you have the input here, is due to the gamma z box. So it's 8% of the value of q weak for the proton, which is 1 minus 4 sine squared Weinberg mechanical. So it is not negligible, but it is one of the examples where these two boson exchange diagram contributions are can be really important in analyzing the fundamental properties of the nucleon. Let's go now into the proton radius puzzle, and Gil gave a great talk during the first day, so I don't need to actually go through the situation with proton radius puzzle. But one of the missing pieces is scattering of the muons on a proton. So we came up with the Muse experiment, and this is a very nice poster that fully describes the Muse experiment. It was Guy Ron is the advisor, and then Cohen is, I think, his student. So this was presented in Israel at a meeting of the Israeli Physical Society. The poster won the first prize. And it gives you all the information about all the questions asked. And here is the PSI facility shown where the experiment will be taken. And so I mean, it's a beautiful explanation of Muse experiment. But to you, let me remind you that Muse experiment is set up to look at proton form factor measurement at very low Q squared, low momentum transfer. The momentum of the beam here is between 100 and 200 MeV over C. And you need, what will be employed will be four different beams, all right? So we'll have electrons, positrons, positive muons, and negative muons. So you have an ability to compare positive and negative muons, positive and negative electrons, and look at the comparison between muon scattering and electron scattering. One complication here is that, of course, there are two photon exchange corrections. It's one situation. Another complication is that when you compare this set of measurements, scattering of lepton, scattering of electrons and muons, you also have to remember that there are some trivial effects due to masses. Of course, there the cross section should be different. And also remember that muon is heavier by a couple of hundred times. So if electron, when it scatters, it easily radiates, but the muon, when it scatters it, at this lower energies, the radiation is much less pronounced. So how do we do?
Also, muons are almost entirely polarized, and electrons are not necessarily.
But the target is unpolarized.
But still, if you cover on a very specific angle, say muons are completely unpolarized, I mean, there's still be a net effect due to polarization, right?
No. No. Target is unpolarized.
Polarization. It's coming from a cloud of pion with decay near the production target, and so it's covering both forward and backward decays. Well, it's not a very polarized beam. It's not like a decay in flight channel where the ions decay forward, giving you good polarization. This is coming from a cloud of ion decays around the production target.
Would they need to monitor the polarization?
No.
I don't understand that at all.
Because the any correlation due to it's the target is unpolarized.
So
the only
I just look at Mohr's formula, right? So there is a terms in the cross sections that depend on the polarization.
They would depend on polarization if the target is polarized.
No.
Oh, Mohr formula, yeah. Yeah. That would be transverse polarization that is caused by higher order, right?
Oh,
higher order.
Product of polarization with some
okay,
momenta and so on.
You're right in a sense that it's a good question because if you look at Mohr formula, this is polarization correlation due to muon or lepton. Polarized perpendicular to the scattering plane.
Perhaps, yes.
The muons in this case are primarily longitudinally polarized. So that asymmetry is proportional to extra alpha.
That,
but then if but if, but if but if but if there is a transverse component of polarization, then there will be a non-zero effect. Yes, you're right. Actually, we can estimate it. But is there any way to check the polarization transverse component?
They can measure the polarization.
Yeah, we have pretty good to actually handle on this.
You think that somehow the transport from the production could polarize them? Because as Doug says, they are. This has been studied in the context of this mega experiment because they would have benefited from polarization.
I see. That's a different story. The Meg experiment uses what's called target muons, that are from pions that stop in the production target and decay at the surface of the production target in one direction. So those Meg mu plus, they use mu plus and they're polarized. But this, what they use is a higher momentum beam that comes from decay of pions very close to the production target. And the pions are going in all different directions, and therefore the polarization is very much reduced.
It's reduced, but it's not zero, right?
It may not be zero.
It cannot be zero.
I don't think it's ever been well characterized.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Right?
We may get an extra percent from that. Yeah, and but good news is the following. If you look at the if you look at the asymmetries due to, extra piece to the cross section, right? Asymmetric piece.
You're worried about the factor of a half in front of the spin average, right?
I'm just recalling that there is a term in one formula where we usually throw away, right? And there is one like that, right? You can probably, in some language, describe it as a spin orbit term or something like that.
It's a spin orbit interaction.
V over C here is order one, so it's in principle not a small contribution. In principle.
You notice the good thing, since the energy is below pion production threshold, it comes due to imaginary part of the amplitude. And you put the intermediate state on mass shell, you realize there are no pions in the intermediate state. So the only thing that contributes would be only elastic proton piece, and it is exactly calculable.
Sure.
Yeah. It's a nice comment actually. It would result in a nice little estimate. All right. So what is the radiative correction for the muon scattering versus electron scattering? We had some Monte Carlo generator that we developed before for Jefferson Lab, but we have updated the generator to avoid assumption that the muon is a light particle. Okay, so we have no longer ultra-relativistic approximation, and when we do this, here is our comparison of radiative correction for electron scattering and muon scattering. So if you cross section, so this is for a condition of mu's measurement, so between 100 and 200 MeV over C. So depending on the scattering angle, your radiative correction to electron scattering can go between +5% and minus, say, 25%, while the radiative correction to muon scattering goes between 1% and something like -1%. So it's a much smaller correction for muon. So if you really want to compare, as the Mu's experiment plans to compare electron and proton, electron and muon cross section, these differences in radiative corrections are a crucial factor in comparing. The experiment Mu's aims at about 1% accuracy or better. We currently estimate the radiative corrections uncertainty at the half percent or maybe 0.25% accuracy.
So when you talk about two-fold effects, you're using the same thing you did for the electron scattering.
We did. Okay, so there are interesting things here happening. So there are when you try to do two-fold effects, mostly it's low energy, so it's primarily the approach with that Blunt and Milnichuk and Chon did, or people for gamma Z box did. But what is interesting here, once you include the mass of the lepton, there are non-trivial things that are that have to be included because the lepton is massive and it's dynamical, not just kinematical. And look at this. So what we did in this paper from last year, we assume that two photons actually can coupled to sigma meson. Okay, so sigma meson is a like quasi-particle, like bound state of two pions. But it couples, it contributes into Compton amplitude, right? It's quite visible in the proton Compton amplitude. So we say, okay, so it is T-channel exchange in Compton scattering. So why not we allow this sigma meson to be exchanged with the proton and muon?
Wait, so isn't there's this sort of a model representation for the subtraction thing in the dispersion relation
It is
that you cannot cut through, right?
So it's a good model for that because I had the forward example, so this is even more complicated.
It's it's a part of fits to nucleon scattering. It shows up there. It shows in polarizabilities and proton polarizability. So we said, why not include this? And we put some constraints. We know how sigma couples to the nucleon. We know the some fits or some models how sigma decays into two photons. So once we know how it couples to two photons, we can calculate the loop here involving two photons. And this is our estimate. So we have for electrons, this type of contribution is at ppm level, so it is like 10^-6. All right, so this is correction due to sigma exchange. But since muon is massive, it ends up to be at something like 0.1%. So it is not negligible.
What do you put for the sigma mass in the T channel? Is there? I mean, it's so wide.
We put a range of masses and we put a range of parameters. That's why we have this broad band. It's whatever is plausible mass. It's a few hundred. It's a few hundred MeV. Actually, 666. It's a magic number. All right. So
if polarization is important in that last effect, then there's going to be a big difference in the beam polarization, possibly between mu plus and mu minus, because the energy distribution of pions that contributes to the mu plus and mu minus cloud is very different for pi plus and pi minus at 600 MeV where they're produced. So this would be a very difficult thing to interpret without knowing the polarization of both the mu plus and the mu minus beam.
Uh-huh.
polarization is important.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you will discuss it. Yeah, it should be included. It's measurable, right? So you just.
It's not easy. For mu plus, it's probably much easier, yeah, than for mu minus. It's
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. Yeah, we might face an extra 1% effect there. Yeah, if you start doing 1% accuracy, it's
so
coming from everywhere.
You have to capture it on light nuclei, right?
Well, you have to do some kind of USR in the right kind of.
No, but not in flight, right?
You have to stop.
Right. But mu minus cascades down to the nucleus, and then a lot of polarization is lost. So this is
true,
like,
for mu plus in many materials too.
Okay.
And polarization is depolarized.
Fantastic. So.
So Mark van der Hagen and his student calculated also two photon exchange. They put full loop there and assumed there are form factors. That was one approach that I show here. And here is the difference. So you see the two photon exchange effect, that's for mu kinematics. It's about 0.5% effect. This is McKinney-Feshbach formula. And if you calculate the two-photon exchange for electron-proton scattering, this is something like this. So electron correction at backward angles is about 1%, while the correction, two-photon exchange correction to muon scattering is at the level of 0.5%. Important if you want to do better than a percent accuracy. So we did some radiative correction calculation due to Bremsstrahlen. That's been taken care of partly by our Monte Carlo generator. And basically, I would finalize here with a statement that the simulation of the radiative effects for this low energy scattering is a big important piece of our effort. We do see that for muons, we can hope for less than 1% correction, and it is included in the analysis. Electron scattering is more affected by this higher order effects, so it is very important to analyze. But the good thing also, it's a nice capability of this MUS experiment, is that you can compare both with negative and positive particles. So if you do the ratios, then you can identify these box diagrams, because they do have different signs for positive and negative leptons. So I have some so conclusion is that we do have procedure for radiative correction calculation. This is work of my grad student, Sasha Koshy. I have some backup slides on single spin asymmetries, but I would rather skip those. So this is basically the status of two-photon exchange.
Thank you. J Park muon beam that's being sort of developed, the one that goes through muon beam, right? That goes through muonium stage, that it's cool, right? And it's very, very well defined, right? So the muons.
The ones for the G minus 2?
The ones that they want for G minus 2. But I'm guessing that the scattering experiment is somewhat simpler than the G minus 2 experiment at that accuracy. So, and the beam, the quality of the beam, well, reportedly is extremely good, right? Because
it's extremely
low energy.
No, it's they want 250. It's re-accelerated, right? It's re-accelerated just before it comes to the thing where they are supposed to be rotating, right? So you could do a scattering experiment. And
on protons, that's what you want.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it strikes me, okay, it's as a
better quality beam that the PSI will have, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things is they're going to do both electron and muon scattering, so they can, you know, directly compare and see if there's some anomalous coupling and you know,
sure,
get rid of some systematics from these kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's an interesting suggestion for this muon proton scattering.
Yeah.
This has not been done since the 60s, so the
70s.
The
Fermi lab in the 70s that did a lot of
because I remember the data from the 60s. This was
called the scattering on carbon and scattering on lead and etc.
Oh, they're talking about lead. Okay, that's something different.
Carbon.
I'm sorry.
I don't see why not. And it might be a good opportunity to take a look into this. I'm not aware of anybody looking into this, so it might be
and
a good.
And also that beam would be very polarized, and you can sort of rotate the polarization on demand because it goes through the slow stage. And,
So there are some like magic energies or angles for.
Magic energy. Right?
Uh-huh.
So magic energy is 3 GeV at Fermilab, and this is going to be 10 times lower.
I see. Okay. Yeah, it's a good idea. So somebody should look into this.
Right.
We will raise this question.
It all works, right?
Is it been used for any scattering measurement? So you can extract this.
They're working on that.
This is like a.
From a muon collider, front end will also be very good.
This is like a pre-booster thing.
Well, we talk about this G minus two and the J lab is like going ahead. Not the J lab, J part, right? The scattering is probably simpler experiment than the measurement of G minus two to one part and 10 to the 10. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good question.
Okay, I don't see any more questions. Doreen and I are going to beg a few more minutes of your attention. Since we're aware that it's lunchtime, it's on a bit of a natural break, and I know a number of you were planning to leave. We thought that we might just have the discussion that was planned for this afternoon, be more of an informal affair, and we wanted to say a few words.
So we do our discussion, short discussion now, and then we got them actually go back to reconvene.
What time do they stop serving?
I don't know. We only have 1 hour
late,
right?
Two? Well, that's
okay. Yeah, so, I mean, we have already lots of discussions, unless there are any physics questions for the talks today. So what we were thinking is just to very quickly solicit maybe some feedback from you. If you think it would be useful to continue the discussion among this group, so an easy way to not to lose momentum or is to set up an email list. And together we have to check this with Richard, who is the main initiator here. And then also, I know that there were some action items already discussed, especially yesterday. So.